My name is Mike Elgin, and this is my Food and Technology Podcast number 6. My guest this week is food writer B. Wilson. Sweet, salty, fatty, junky. Here comes the Fatcast. The Fatcast is a weekly conversation with visionaries who are making the world a better place. You can find the Fatcast online at elgin.com, and you can subscribe on iTunes or from the podcast app of your choice. Thanks for listening. I am having a great time doing the Fatcast, and I hope you're enjoying it too. This podcast is really a labor of love. It's something I'm never going to stop doing. My first goal for the Fatcast is to move from iTunes' new and noteworthy bucket into the editor's choice or featured collections buckets or some other category that makes it easier for people to find and listen to. You can help. In fact, only you can help. By giving me a review or a star rating on iTunes, you can help people discover the Fatcast. You can also help by rating the other ratings. In iTunes, next to every review is a question. Was this review helpful? By clicking yes or no, you can boost the higher quality reviews to the top, all of which improves the rankings of the podcast. So I want to thank you in advance for helping me on iTunes. On this week's Fatcast, we're talking about food preferences and where they come from. Are we born with them? Do we learn them along the way? It's an important topic because the foods we choose affect our health and happiness, and most of our food-related illnesses are caused by the wrong choices. People are often irrational about food or have unexpected preferences. I've personally known two people diagnosed with advanced diabetes, both of whom had limbs surgically removed as a result, and both of whom knew exactly what kind of food caused their health catastrophe, but who refused to change their diet, saying they would rather die than eat healthy food. I know some people who love everything and others who are super picky eaters. And everybody knows where the best pizza in the world is. It's always the place where we ate pizza as a kid. Why do people make the choices they do? And what's the solution to making better ones? My guest this week is the UK's favorite food writer, B. Wilson. She's written 5 incredible, fantastic books. The first was The Hive, the story of the honeybee and us. Her second book, Swindled, From Poison Sweets to Counterfeit Coffee, The Dark History of Food Cheats, is, of course, all about food cheating and food counterfeiting. Her next two books were food history books. Sandwich, A Global History, and Consider the Fork, A History of How We Cook and Eat, were both incredible looks at the history of food. Her most recent book is all about food preferences. It's called First Bite, How We Learn to Eat. If you want to follow Bea, I guess the best place to do that is on Twitter. Her Twitter name is Kitchen Bee. That's Kitchen Bee. All right, here's my conversation with food writer and food historian, B. Wilson. B. Wilson, welcome to the Fatcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I'm glad you're on this show because I love your books. You've written 5, I believe, with First Bite, How We Learn to Eat, being your most recent book. Some of these books cover food history. Some of them cover areas of interest, for example, Swindled was one of your books that talks about food counterfeiting and food cheating. And First Bite, of course, is How We Learn to Eat. That's not a food history book, but again, you've done history as well. If you were not to call yourself a food writer, which is pretty general, what would you call yourself? Are you a food historian? Are you a food philosopher? What comes after food if you had to describe yourself and couldn't use the word writer?
I find it hard. Maybe food thinker. I find almost any other way of describing myself comes across as sounding too pompous. I often get introduced as historian and food writer, and I'm happy with that. But you're right. My latest book, First Bite, it isn't really history. There are elements of history in there, but it's much more psychology and little bits of anthropology and neuroscience and really, it's about how we all eat now and how we can change rather than how we ate in the past, which was the subject that I explored in my previous books.
I love and share your optimism about the ability for people to change, not individuals, of course, individuals can, but for all of us, for cultures, for our culture to eventually someday get ourselves off of the horrible food that's making everybody so sick and also enabling people to learn the joy of real food and good food. But I hope you're right. I'm looking forward to a world when people really, get to eat real food.
Yeah, I mean, I really hope the optimism is not misplaced, but I didn't know when I started research on this book. Well, I didn't really know much about the book. I thought it was going to be about children's food rather than about how both children and adults can change. And I just kept having these eureka moments as I was doing the research. I didn't know, I was going to call the subtitle How We Learn to Eat, because I was quite agnostic when I began the research. I thought I might find out that the preponderance of our likes and dislikes were somehow innate. But actually, it looks as if, based on twin studies, at most around 20% of our relationship with different flavors can be accounted for by genes. The rest of it's environment, it's nurture. And on the one hand, you could look at that in a really depressing sort of doom-mongering way and say, well, we've got this terrible food environment in which kids are learning to eat, so that makes it even worse. But at least if it's environment, that holds out a glimmer of hope that we can change, that we can relearn our relationship with food. And I guess my optimism also came, I didn't realize when I started the book either that I was going to be talking so much about my own relationship with food. But I just kept reading these various things about the obesity crisis or food politics in general and the problem that our food supply is in, and thinking there was a big part of the picture missing, which is that for some people it's actually quite easy to eat in a balanced way, even in this dysfunctional food world we find ourselves in, and for other people it's tremendously hard. And I was coming at this from the angle that I used to be one of the people who really struggled. I was unhappy about eating, I was a compulsive eater, there was no stop button on my consumption. And now I can honestly say food is not guilt and shame, and I don't go on diets, and I find it relatively straightforward, give or take the odd moment. And I really wanted to explore how is it possible for some people to learn these eating skills in a way that makes food a joy and a pleasure, and for other people it seems so difficult.
You cited research that shows clearly that kids can learn to enjoy all kinds of things, especially very young children. They really don't have major preferences between the healthiest foods and the least healthy. And yet most children avoid many foods they acquire a preference for later on. Why is kids' food or children's food an identifiable category, do you think?
Yeah, I think it's really problematic. We put all these labels on kids' food. I mean, this is the one bit of the book where I did go back to history because I thought it was important to explore just how dramatically our concept of children's food has changed. So for a previous generation, going back to certainly Victorian times, Edwardian, even pre-war, even mid-20th century, there was an idea that children's food was something that should be really nourishing, but not at all pleasurable. You'll actually sort of get these accounts in childcare books coming out of both the States and Britain saying, children, they shouldn't be enjoying food too much. And this suggestion that various categories of food are very dangerous for them, even things like omelette shouldn't be given to 11-year-olds, salad is dangerous, fruit is dangerous, all these things that we would now be so delighted if our children would eat, were viewed with suspicion as if they might somehow give a child indigestion or be in some way upsetting to them. Whereas now we've just swung to the opposite extreme. We don't feel kids' food is something nourishing. It's all about pandering to a child's palate. There's a lot of it that's very cynically marketed by the food industry. If you look at kids' cereals, it's crazy. They're the ones that, of all the cereals on the aisle, are the highest in sugar when you'd think it might be the opposite. Whereas the way ideally we ought to be feeding kids would be a balance kind of halfway between the two. Yes, they should be eating food that's good for them, but also they should be enjoying it. I mean, the idea that kids enjoy food, that isn't a bad idea that we've come up with in modern times. It's just we seem to have this notion that they'll only enjoy themselves if they're eating French fries and various kinds of processed cheese and all kinds of candy. And actually, that's completely wrong. When a child is born, they have no taste other than for milk. It's all up for grabs. We are the ones, largely as parents, who form their tastes with our own assumptions and with the foods we offer them.
I wonder about that, though, because clearly, at least in the United States, marketing is an enormous influence. And I think it's an influence on both children and their parents. And there's a clear attempt by junk food marketers to get the kids to beg their parents to buy certain cereals and so on. You think about Ronald McDonald and McDonald's, and how, you know, McDonald's builds playgrounds. They're clearly targeting children. McDonald's strategy from a purely marketing point of view is more thorough than, say, the breakfast cereal marketing, because they're trying to get kids into food that they will continue to eat. Whereas, you know, Fruit Loops or whatever, unless you work in Silicon Valley, you're probably going to stop eating Fruit Loops at some point.
You're right. Whereas the McDonald's thing of the Happy Meal, that's a kind of starter meal. And then the idea is you'll eventually get the taste for it and graduate onto the Big Mac. Yeah, there's a huge amount of, I'm not blaming parents at all when I say that we form our children's tastes. We're forming them in an environment in which our own tastes have so much been formed by junk food, by ultra-processed food. It's really hard to break those strong positive emotional associations so many of us have as adults with these fast foods. I know I had this much more, even though I'm saying I have a much happier relationship with food than I did, and I'm glad that I'd learned to eat in a somewhat balanced way before I had kids. But my kids are very spaced out in age. I have a 16-year-old, a 13-year-old, and a 6-year-old. With my 16-year-old, when he was a baby, I was a really young mom, and I still had these kind of happy associations with places like McDonald's. And I somehow felt that it was important that he should have a happy meal every so often, and that I got very excited about the toy. And now I look back and think, why on earth would I do that? Why would I buy into this gigantic marketing scheme? So I absolutely see how easy it is for parents. And you're right, the pester power of kids seeing adverts on TV. And I used to beg my mother for various things that I'd seen. And it's extremely hard for parents to say no. And indeed, some of the marketing is so clever. Parents feel they're actually doing the best thing by their kids by buying some of these things. It will say, these cookies are pediatrician approved or something. And you think, well, what does that mean? It's crazy. Which pediatrician? But we've been given a lot of mixed and damaging messages about food. So it's not an easy environment in which to learn either how to eat or how to feed someone.
There's also a clear trend toward offering hopefully higher quality versions of children's foods. For example, in New York City, I think there are dozens of mac and cheese joints. I went to a really good bakery in San Francisco a couple of days ago and had a cinnamon toast, which is, I don't know if this is something that children have in the UK, but I imagine it is, where you butter the toast and then you just dump cinnamon mixed with sugar on it. And it was, you know, a $4 slice of toast. It was really good bread. It was ancient grains, naturally leaven, and so on. But it was cinnamon. It was clearly targeting nostalgic eating from people who remember things from their childhood. Why is food so closely associated with nostalgia?
Well, really, because the single greatest driving force that is pushing all of our food desires is memory. We know this. All of our likes and dislikes are basically a product of memory. And so, of course, if as kids we're brought up on this kid food, whether it's cinnamon toast, whether it's Big Macs, whatever, that kind of sweet, salty hit, we become imprinted with those flavors. So as adults, of course, we're going to seek them out. And it's not even some. With something like that, you can actually be conscious, oh, I'm having a nostalgic moment here and I'm actually going to eat this in a sort of semi-ironic, but actually I'm really enjoying it kind of way. But I think a lot more of it is subconscious. I think very often we're almost just like rats in an alleyway, driven this way or that by forces we're not really aware of when it comes to food. So many of the memories are formed in the first 2 years of life. When we're not conscious of them, they're even being formed in utero. There were these amazing experiments done where mothers were asked to drink a lot of carrot juice in the last trimester of pregnancy, and their kids went on to prefer the taste of carrot-flavored cereal several months later. So if you imagine that process being replicated across hundreds of foods, by the time you're aware of having likes and dislikes, you may be completely imprinted with these positive associations of that kind of sweet, salty, fat flavor hit. And if I look at the foods that so many young foodies, and I know it's the same in New York, San Francisco, same in London, so many of the foods that these young gourmets gravitate towards, and these are people that eat better than the general population, it's basically the same flavor matrix as a Big Mac. It's kind of salted caramel, it's pulled pork with sweet barbecue sauce. It's all of these kind of sweet, salty, kind of fatty, junky, but it's somehow meant to be good because it's being made by a chef foods. But it shows our actual palates have been formed by these foods. You know, kids' food is what you learn how to eat with. So of course we're going to still have that palate unless we somehow reboot our taste so that we have a different preference.
Well, you mentioned that these preferences are formed subconsciously. There's an attempt to form them consciously. Can you talk about the Saperi method or movement and what that's all about?
Yeah. So the Saperi movement, it was invented in France, but it's been applied most extensively over the past 10 years in Finland. So Finland noticed about a decade ago that they had worse rates of child obesity than their neighbours in Sweden and other Scandinavian countries. And they decided to do something about it. And it started off just as an experiment in one town, and they then applied it across the whole country. The idea is that the whole of education for preschool children centres around food, but it's not the kind of lectures on healthy eating that we're so familiar with in US schools and UK schools. It's not saying eat your five a day. It's about exploring food through the senses. And the thought is that actually you're then banking new positive memories of fresh, real, whole foods, whether it's berries. So they might have days where they explore different types of berries, or other days where they taste lots of sour foods and say which ones they prefer. And so far, it's early days, but the results seem really encouraging, both for gradually lowering child obesity, but also the kids are going home and saying to their parents, we tasted this strange new vegetable today. It was great. Can we please buy it?
Okay, so children's preferences are pretty easy to map, I think, if you really, really think about it. I mean, we see children with all kinds of influences in every direction. But where do gender norms about food preferences come from?
These are so complicated. I mean, with gender norms, as with anything to do with eating, I'm not saying we're starting as blank slates. All of us bring different experiences to bear. And the same applies when you look at gender. Women and men have somewhat different responses to flavor. We know that women are actually overall more sensitive to flavors than to men, than men are. Sometimes marketeers say, if you're trying to market a food to boys and girls, you've got to get the packaging right for the boys and you've got to get the flavor right for the girls. And that's a huge generalization. But broadly speaking, we feed boys and girls to an extraordinary extent still in this day and age in different ways. And this is cultural, it's social. And so many of the ways that we encourage boys and girls to eat are actually go exactly opposite what their nutritional requirements are. So with boys, you can see this across many different cultures. You can see it in Thailand, you can see it in the United States, you can see it in France. There's a view that the manly foods are meat and hearty main courses in general, and that boys need building up. And parents, and this obviously isn't every family, but enough that it could be mapped statistically, parents put less pressure on boys to eat vegetables, which is really unhelpful because we can also see across different cultures that generally boys have even higher obesity levels than girls do. Whereas with girls, we're not encouraging them to eat those hearty main courses. And yet what girls have is like this huge leap in their iron requirements. As they go through puberty, they go from needing 8 milligrams of iron a day to needing 15 because of periods. And yet we're somehow feeding girls with these delusions that they can subsist on chocolate and a few lettuce leaves. Whereas they, if anyone needs a steak, and you could argue that no one does, but if anyone does, it's a girl and not a boy. And I found it fascinating and quite depressing the extent to which in various studies you could see that families were still pressurizing girls to eat less. There was a big study that came out of Minnesota involving thousands of families that was longitudinal. It followed them over a five-year period. And as the girls entered their later teens, the families were putting more pressure on them to lose weight. Whereas with the boys, they were just backing off, saying, eat what you like. And we know that when you put pressure on a child to lose weight, it tends to be very counterproductive. And it's also psychologically damaging. These people often end up having a much more fractured and disordered relationship with eating than they otherwise would.
And of course, there are preference differences among cultures. What does the smell of mint do to Algerian brains, and why?
I found this extraordinary when I read this piece of research. So some researchers worked with two different groups of people, French Algerians, who had grown up with the scent of mint tea. It's just a natural part of life among French Algerians. There's always a pot of mint tea on the table. It's something that you would either be drinking it as an adult or as a child. It's part of the landscape, that scent of mint. And then they took another group of just European French people. They attached gold electrodes to their scalps, and they scanned what was happening as they inhaled the scent of mint. And it was fascinating because for the French Algerians, it actually created much more cortical activity than it did for the Europeans. It was as if somehow the French people could smell this was mint, they recognized it, but only the Algerians heard the music of it. It took up a larger part of their brain. It meant more to them. It resonated.
One of the things that I find fascinating about intercultural differences is that some of our most prized foods are absolutely revolting to people outside of our own culture. If you think about cheese, for example, a very simple thing, I love cheese. But for anyone who comes from a non-dairy-oriented culture, cheese is the stuff of nightmares. Think of haggis or uni from Japan. Some of our favorite foods are foods that you would think would never enter the human diet. I mean, how did cheese, for example, ever enter our diet, especially if you think of the best kind of cheese, the French kind of cheese, the moldy kind of cheese? How did we end up eating this moldy, disgusting, clearly spoiled dairy product? And why do cultures prize these less accessible foods as much as they do, do you think?
But I think that even that begs the question, because you're saying these less accessible foods. I mean, I think you're right. It's really strange. A strong component of disgust wherever you are is food that seems to be close to being rotten. So, and then these things don't translate well from one culture to another. So lots of Western people will say they have a real problem with kimchi, the Korean fermented cabbage pickle, even though if you're brought up in Korea, that's absolutely as delicious as cheese might be disgusting if you're brought up in Korea. Whereas to us, if you're brought up with a lovely Parmesan or even Roquefort or those cheeses which are really far to the edge, that can just seem like mother's milk to you. I think that's a good question, because it kind of gets at the question of, is there such a thing as a taste which is objectively disgusting? And there are certain things you can say that people who've studied disgust in different cultures, actually it's often the animal foods that revolt us more than the vegetable foods. Children are resistant about vegetables, but the things that actually revolt us in a visceral way tend to be animal foods, weird species or weird body parts. And the thought is that it partly reminds us too much that we're animals ourselves. And the same thing with rotten foods, with something like cheese, there's a thought that it somehow reminds us of decay and death. But then, as you as a cheese lover know, you can easily overcome it and reach the point where you kind of appreciate the complexity. And I think the process that goes on in learning to love something like cheese, I have the example at the end of my book of chili. I mean, that's such an aversive substance. Objectively, if there were such a thing, it's really unpleasant. It's painful to put it in your mouth. And yet millions of people every year are acquiring a love of chili. It happens kind of almost by osmosis in places like Mexico. As a child, you don't love chili. It's not that it doesn't taste as strong to people in those places. It absolutely does. It's just that they're watching and learning and seeing other people at the table eating it and enjoying it and surviving. And then they gradually try it. And then maybe they don't like it straight away, but they try it again. And this is how we learn to love any food, no matter how strange or difficult it might seem at first.
And of course, very spicy foods cause a release of endorphins in the same way that drinking a fizzy drink does, where it's actually little tiny pinpricks of pain, and our bodies try to compensate for any pain we're feeling by giving us dopamine and other things. So chocolate is one road to that. Spicy peppers is another. Yeah. And so we also, there's an addictive quality, I think, to that response that our bodies have. And there are multiple ways to achieve that culturally. It's just, I've known small children who can just eat jalapeno peppers like candy, and it's really impressive because I cannot. I love spicy food. I just can't handle massive quantities of it. Okay, so you write a lot about special cases where people are extremely picky for some reason or another. There's a whole spectrum, I imagine, from people who only eat one type of food all the way to people who love all kinds of food. I think I would place myself closer to the latter category. But why are some people so picky about what they eat?
Well, there is a whole spectrum, and there is a strong genetic component to this. So when I'm saying everyone can learn to eat better, which they can, I'm not saying we're all starting from the same point of view. It's tremendously difficult for some families. A lot of kids who really struggle with acquiring more than a few tastes are on the autistic spectrum. And there are lots of reasons. Some kids have a kind of oral defensiveness. The food feels different in their mouths. There are kids that have fear of lumps. There are kids, it often goes along with other forms of learning disability. If kids who are slower to speak may also be slower to eat. They may have problem chewing. They may have problems swallowing. Every element of the mechanics of eating is actually more complex and difficult than we generally allow. But even allowing for that, I was really encouraged to find while doing the research for my book that there have been people at feeding clinics. There's one in Pennsylvania run by a remarkable man called Keith Williams, where they've succeeded in training these kids who are tremendously resistant to food, scared of food. They're so scared that if someone enters the room carrying a plate of unfamiliar food before they've even seen what it is, they vomit spontaneously. It's that bad. I mean, so for the parents, it's an awful thing to be living with, and it can seem quite hopeless. The kids often end up being fed by tube. But at this clinic, they've pioneered these techniques, one of which is just to use minuscule pieces of food the size of a grain of rice and repeated exposure. We've known about exposure being the main way that you acquire new likes for a long time, but the catch-22, as any parent will confirm, is how do you expose a child to broccoli when they don't want to put it in their mouth even once, never mind 10 to 15 times? And even if they did put it in their mouth, attempting to swallow a whole mouthful is such an unpleasant experience that actually the exposure doesn't work. It's a nasty experience, and that isn't the sort of exposure you need. But if you reduce the size of the food being tasted to the grain of a size of a grain of rice or a pea, it suddenly becomes possible for the child to put it in their mouth and to repeat it multiple times, and then to get to the point where they're actually asking for larger pieces of this food. And then once the dislike becomes liked, there's no problem anymore. As any of us, this is the great mystery of taste. Once you like something, you can't quite imagine how you ever didn't. And another related technique, which I think is great and which I've been doing more with my youngest child since I finished writing the book, is called Plate A, Plate B. And at this same feeding clinic in Pennsylvania, it's been shown this one works well with older children, teenagers, or even with adults. Plate A has three different disliked foods, again, the size of a grain of rice. Plate B is normal-sized portions of food that the child or the adult currently likes, and you just take alternate mouthfuls. And it sounds kind of too simple to be true, or it sounds like it wouldn't really work. And I've found in my own family, it's amazing, because my child, that's my pickiest eater, contamination is a big one of his worries. he doesn't want that dislike food anywhere near the plate. So to have it safely corralled onto a separate plate, that's quite useful in itself. And then the act that he's choosing, so of those three on the separate plate, there might be one that he really doesn't want to go near, but he can choose the second one or the third one. And something about the act of choosing makes that food more desirable. It does seem like it works better than other things. I mean, you'd think that it's not possible to break through these dislikes because they become so entrenched.
In general, though, it's very hard to convince other people, whether they're our own children or spouses or readers, to change what they eat. And you, in this book, don't try very hard to convince, you're not shaming people into changing their diets. You're not doing anything beyond talking about why people choose. Why is it so hard to convince other people? Why is it so hard to be persuasive when you have a great argument about why somebody should be eating something different from what they're actually eating?
We hate being persuaded. We don't want to be persuaded, particularly when it comes to something as intimate as what we put in our mouth. The minute you attempt to advise someone what to eat, their defenses go up. And this is partly what the book's trying to grapple with, because so many of our problems are public health problems with the shocking state that so many people's diet is in this terrible food environment. And governments with the best intentions in the world keep trying to stem the tide with all of these pieces of advice or these directives. But none of them are going to work, because that isn't how we change the way we eat. In fact, the more we feel lectured at, the less likely we are to change. Because as soon as you place food in a category marked should, it doesn't seem particularly delicious. The only way you're going to get there is somehow to have enough foods which are good for you in the category of foods that you also think are delicious. And then it's easy. But I do try not to. I mean, shame is a really ineffective way to get people to eat better. Shame makes people go away and eat things in secret and eat what they really want. And, well, suddenly, back in my compulsive eating days, shame was a big part of how I ate or didn't eat in public and then ate in private. Shame is not a good thing. When people say, apropos of the obesity crisis, oh, it's quite simple, these people, they just need to eat less and move more. It's such, well, apart from the fact it's a really unsympathetic and not very thoughtful response, it's also really unrealistic. That's not how someone changes. If the odds are, if someone is obese, they know all of the advice on nutrition. They know about five a day. It's not about stupidity. It's not about moral value. It's not about willpower or virtue. It's about habits and preferences acquired over a lifetime. And it's extremely difficult to change your habits and preferences. But what I'm trying to do in my book is just point out, well, this is possible. And these are some of the ways people have changed. And these are ways that people probably don't change.
Do you think social media will have an impact? I mean, people are always sharing food photos. And I know that I have a social media audience that is very international. And almost everything that I post, there are people from other countries that have never seen that category of food before. And there are people from my own country or from Europe or Japan or somewhere highly industrialized that have never seen the non-industrialized version of it. And so, and likewise, I discover all kinds of foods from other people's posts where it makes me think, huh, you know, maybe I should make that. Maybe I should try to find that. Maybe I should buy that food. And so there's a lot of sharing. There's a lot of information now that didn't used to exist about what other people are eating. Do you think that'll have an effect on we as a species changing our diets and embracing real food instead of the industrial junk food that's really making us sick and obese and so on?
I hope sharing of ideas will help. I mean, that's what I'm trying to do with the book. I'd like to get the ideas out there as much as possible, for whether it's for parents trying to wean a child and thinking, actually, there are ways I could do this, that it's not going to be easy, but maybe if I thought about building up their palate, that would be the way to go, rather than worrying so much about them eating a huge portion of this nutritious food all in one go. I would like to get these ideas out there for people who are unhappy about food, to see that there is a glimmer of hope and that you can change your tastes and you can change your relationship with food. The social media thing, I think in some ways it's benign and great. As you say, for some people, it just creates this open-mindedness and the sharing of ideas. And I explore in the book, one of the main ways as adults we're likely to change our palates would be through travel. So maybe social media is almost like a proxy for travel. But I'm also struck that so much of the conversation around food on social media is really polarized. On the one hand, there are lots of people who have these kind of threads just celebrating junk food in a fairly unreconstructed way. And on the other hand, there are the extreme clean eating people who are trying to push some perfectionist idea that if you sort of put the wrong nutrient in your mouth, then you're somehow contaminated. And I don't think that's a healthy or balanced way to eat at all. But you're right, these technological tools, there's hope. I mean, it's potentially a great democratic way for people to share ideas about diet.
Bea, I need an exclusive here. What's your next book about?
I'm just thinking about that. I'm doing so much radio and podcasts like this one at the moment that I'm finding it hard to sit down and actually write the proposal. But it's something else about how we eat, maybe in a global way. But that's very vague. I'm pinning down ideas at the moment.
Okay, well, when you do publish that book, because I mean, given your track record, the things that you've covered are just like so fascinating. Your food history, this whole question of food, you know, counterfeit food, I find so fascinating. And of course, this book, First Bite, How We Learn to Eat, such fascinating work that I really look forward to your next book. And I'll leave you alone now so you can go work on that proposal.
Thank you very much.
And great to talk to you. And I want to thank you so much for coming on the FatCast.
Thanks for having me.
I'd love to hear from you. Email your ideas and feedback to mike@elgin.com. Thanks for listening to my weekly food and technology podcast. And don't forget to share it with a friend. My name is Mike Elgin. There goes the FatCast.